Thank you, I think. What's all about? I drive 4 hours and that's what I get? Jeez, I don't know. Although I did get the gift card. So, hey, come on now. Julie Alcoholic? It's good to be here. Thank you, Lee, for inviting me. And thanks, Hilda, for driving up with me. I hate driving, you know, and I hate driving a long way and then having to speak on top of it. So it's kind of great that that you volunteered, so thank you. I think you volunteered, right? So the accent is Irish, just in case you're wondering. And, you know, I was raised in this kind of house where it was my mother had 13 children, and I know, Irish Catholic, and seven passed away, and there were six of us, and so I became the second youngest. And then she left my father when she was pregnant with my younger sister, and we moved to England. And my house was kind of wild. I was raised in a very wild house. There was a lot of stuff going on all the time, and it was really crazy. And, you know, when my kind of independently, you know, my mum used to, every day she'd go for a drink in this pub called the White Hart, and the locals used to call it Maggot's Corner, you know, because you know how we roll. And I'd go back to school with my younger sister, and we'd stay there all evening with my mother. And sometimes we'd sit in the back of the car and she'd bring us out a bag of chips and a bottle of Coke, or sometimes we'd go in. And I learned at a very early age, it'd be all Irish men, you know, and the Irish are so melancholy, you know, we always miss home and singing songs and all that carry on and crying into our beer, and then we have a fight, and it's just how we roll. And so, you know, I used to go up to this. I learned at a very early age, if I sat on one of these guys' knees, I'd get like 50 cents or like a swig of their beer. And I'd like to think, like, I've tried really hard in my spirit to keep myself in good nick. I'd like to think that I'd get at least a quarter if I ever relapsed, you know what I mean? Like, I could still work the bar. Like, in my fantasy. I share that about being raised in bars because I really was very comfortable in them. I was in them every day, and I was raised in them. And it was so hard when I got sober, because what do you do with your time? Like, I became a bar drinker like my mother, and I wouldn't, like, I was just a bar fly. And I didn't understand what you do. And for the first year of my sobriety, I spent it in a bar. And I'll talk a little bit about that as I get longer into my pitch. And, you know, for me, I was very intense and very concerned as a child. Very concerned. And I started to kind of independently drink, which means stealing it from my mother's liquor cabinet. But, you know, like, there was this cabinet that had a magnet, and it used to make a click-click noise when you opened it, right? And I used to be able to open that without the magnets making that noise, and I thought it was a gift from Jesus. Like, obviously Jesus wants me in here, right? Like, I know you all agree with that kind of thinking. Oh, well, Jesus organized that parking spot for me. So it's like, Jesus helped me open that cupboard, but the magnet's not going off, so he wants me in there. And my mother used to smuggle over poutine. You guys would call it moonshine, right? But we call it poutine in Irish. And my mother would smuggle this poutine over from Ireland in statues of the Blessed Virgin Mary. You know the holy water bottles where you screw the head off Mary and you put the holy water in? Well, she'd pour the water out, and she'd, so, you know, irreverent, and she'd pour the poutine in, and she'd have it all lined up, you know, in the back, with all these statues of Mary and all us kids, and she'd be going through customs, and they'd open the trunk, and it'd be all these kids and all these statues, and they're like, oh, she's a single woman, so they're like, oh, off you go, love. God bless you, you know. So, like, I started to kind of get to that cabinet and open it, and I'd look for the crown on Mary's head, and I'd find her, and I'd screw the head off Mary, and I'd have a swig. And you actually can't breathe when you drink poutine. I've never drank moonshine, but poutine, you're like this, like, like, you actually, veins pop out. You can't breathe, but you know it's going to be worth it. Like, you know. You just got to hang on in there. And aren't we good at that? We're hanging on in here because we know we can see the light at the end of a tunnel. And usually it's a train coming towards us, but whatever. You know, it's like, here it is. So I do that, and I'm delighted with myself. About 20 minutes, I put Mary's head back on, put her back up. And I go in, I'm dancing around the kitchen, I'm smoking some cigarette butts that were left in the ashtray and some cigars, and I'm great for about 20 minutes. And then I look for Mary again and off we go. And that's how it was for me. And the thing that booze gave me was that intensity and concern I had about everybody left. Like, I suddenly became arrogant and indifferent. Like, indifferent. Now, I didn't, obviously, I was 10. I didn't know. But that was, like, what I just chased. That feeling of indifference. Now, when I got sober, my first 10 years of sobriety, I got 2 ulcers because I got very concerned again. But, you know, for that period of time, that feeling of not caring about you and your sad little life and your sad little opinions was so freeing for me. I was so indifferent, and I loved that, you know, and I started to take off, my drinking started to take off. I don't know about this invisible line business. I have no clue. You know, the book talks about an invisible line. That's never been my experience drinking. I never had a period of drinking socially. I pretended I was. But you know, when you are drinking and you're just drinking with somebody, so it looks like you're drinking socially. And like you have to drink more than they're drinking, because you don't want them to think, especially if you're drinking with a man, you don't want them to think that they're better than you. And so you're trying to drink as more than them. So every time they take a swig, you take a bigger swig. And then you're waiting. You're just waiting for them to buy the next thing. Or if they're not drinking at all, you're thinking, what, man? How can I get away from this fella? You know, it's like, oh, it's brutal. So, like, I was, you know, for me, my drinking took off. Boom. When I think back about it, about obsession, right, from the gate, from that moment where I didn't feel that I cared about you anymore and I felt indifferent, that was in my mind all the time. And so obsession creeps in, right? And so when I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. And when I'm not drinking and thinking about drinking, I'm getting over drinking. That's just how it was. And that's how it was all the way through my drinking years. Like, I never had a reprieve on that. That was always how it was. And I always share this. And if you're new and you don't identify, it's fine. But for me, as soon as I started drinking, I started to cut myself. Suddenly out of nowhere. That was just part of my drinking. Anything sharp, I would just cut myself, and it was a secret. And I share that because that's how unwell I was at 10 years of age. Like, as soon as I started drinking, that was what happened to me. Like, I had none of this, let's just... And booze was always available to me because my mother was a drunk, still is. And I started to work at an Irish club when I was 14, and there was always booze available. And so I never had a problem with that, but I was still in obsession. It always felt like there was never enough, and I started to drink at school. And, you know, Irish Catholic school. And across the street was a little liquor store, and I used to go in and get 4 cans of wine at lunchtime. 4 cans of wine, really. Like, I don't think I'd even ever seen a grape, right? But it was like, I'd grab those 4 cans of wine, I'd go into the toilets, and I'd crack open those 4 cans, and I'd get them down as quick as possible, because I was on a schedule, I'd be back in class. And I was on my own. I'm not a sharer. Like, as I got longer into my drinking, I realized I'm kind of antisocial in that way. Like, I'm not interested in you. And I'm not sharing with you. And, like, I always used to say to you, God, are you still talking? Did you say something? Like, and they'd be like, Jesus, you're brutal. And I'm like, get a clue. I don't want to talk to you. Like, I was just rough. And you know, and that was how I was. Really aggressive and kind of rough with people. And I'm cursed being Irish, because when I drink, I go bright red from like here all the way up. And it's like, have you ever seen like piss holes in the snow? Have you ever seen that? Well, you're California. Dig deep and think about it. Use your imagination. You're like, people look at California. What? Huh? Snow? What's that look like? So, you know, my eyes are like that. Like, I'm bright red, almost kind of purple, and my eyes are like whoop whoop, like backup lights. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and that's how I was. And I thought that people didn't know I wasn't drinking. And people are, like, I'd go back to class, and people are like, Jesus, are you all right? You know, and I'd be like, oh, I'm good, like, I'm good. And then as soon as I go home, I'd start drinking again, stealing my mum's booze, and then working that night. And nobody paid attention. And here's the funny thing: I was raised in a home with a lot of violence and a lot of discipline in that way. If you just look sideways, you got it. And we all, you know, we were all kind of ducking, and that's how I was raised. So there's a lot of aggression, a lot of discipline in that way. But there was really very little discipline about achieving anything. Like, or like, I expect you to do this. There was never any of that in my home. Like, my mother was caught up in her own alcoholism, and she was drinking. She worked in a laundromat, and she'd be drinking there, and she'd come home, and she'd often come home, and she'd say, like, she'd take the, you know, those rabbit ears off the telly. She'd take those off the telly. She'd be enraged that we were as kids watching telly, and she'd put them in her handbag, and she'd leave for the night. And we'd have to entertain ourselves, which we did. You know, let's see who can stab each other with a fork first. That kind of entertaining. So I was kind of raised with that. So there was no discipline, and there was no expectations of us. And I lived up to every one of them. And so, like, I didn't realize that. But so I was very undisciplined. So, like, I just do what I feel like doing. If I don't feel like showing up, I'm not showing up. I don't care if I've told you I'm going to show up. I'm not interested. Lack of discipline was my dilemma. I had no clue. And of course, we talk about the idea of integrity being sober, right? You know, we agree to do something, and even though something better comes along, we still stick to what we agreed to do because that's how we build integrity. That was a total alien concept for me. And when I got sober and people would say, can you put away the chairs? I'd like, I'll put my chair away. Like, can you help with the tea and coffee? I don't drink hot beverages, which is a lie, I do. Or can you put away the ashtrays? You know, like, I don't smoke. Like, I think that people are trying to take advantage of me. And then people have said, do you want to take the commitment, Julie, for something? I'm like, what? Well, no, I don't mind helping you out tonight because I'm here. What? What's that? A year? Are you out of it? Like, what? Are you high? You want me to take a commitment for a year? Hell no. No. Like, it frightened the life out of me because I used to think, what about if something better happens next week? Yeah. And I know, exactly. Like, what about if something better next week comes along and then I feel like I have to be here and I'm going to be resentful of you and then I can't come to this meeting anymore? No. So I just didn't do any commitments. I didn't understand because I wasn't disciplined. I had no discipline. I just do what I feel like doing. And the idea is showing up or being committed to anything frightens the life out of me. Because I know it's just a resentment waiting to happen. And trust me, I have enough of them without creating them. And so, you know, that kind of lack of discipline really was a detriment for me when I got sober. Because if you've been sober any longer than 5 minutes, you know there's a certain amount of discipline that is required. Like, we show up consistently somewhere, we get a commitment, people get to know us, we call people, we show up when we say we're going to, even though we don't want to, half the time, or most of the time, depending on who you are. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting, so I was so undisciplined in that way, and you know, I started to kind of get into a bit of trouble. I started to work in the East End of London, you know, and I left home when I was 19, and started to work in the East End of London. And I want to become a nun. Yes, people. Can you see it? And I was in the East End of London, and I started to live in the nurses' quarters. The Irish Sisters of Charity ran this, and I was going to get spiritually fit and become a nun. And my drinking took off, and I asked them if they would put me on the floor with the other sisters. And they did, which was their first mistake. So I was on this floor, and it was like all nuns around me, and my little room was like a 3x6, and the curtains were lime green, a little blue trash can, a little metal can, green lime carpet. You know how wonderful that is. And at night I'd start drinking, and I'm a barroom drinker, but when I'm trying to control and enjoy my drinking, which is a total joke, I start to try and drink in my room, and I'm playing Guns N' Roses. You know, like, turn around, bitch, I got use for you. Besides, you ain't got nothing better to do and I'm bored. And I'm like, yeah, and I'm praised, you know. I don't know if you got any of you guys remember. Do any of you guys remember that song? White lines going through my mind, and all the while I think of you. Boom, boom, boom. It's like, woo, bam, give me some whiskey. You know what I mean? So I was like, woo, like, praised. You know the book where it talks about being insanely drunk? We don't want to just feel relaxed. I like to feel insanely drunk. That's just how I like to roll. Like, I don't understand why you wouldn't. I really just don't understand that concept. You know, so for me, I started to get into a lot of trouble. So I'm doing that, and I'm in my room, and I'm listening to these songs. I'm drinking a bottle of whiskey, and I'm cutting myself. And nobody's in there. It's only me. And Sister Anna would be tapping on the door. Julie, lovey, okay. And I'd be like crazed behind the door. It's like just so crazy. I started to get into a lot of trouble. I started to, I used to drink, and she'd put her trash can outside the door. Every night we'd put our trash cans outside. And you could eat out my trash can, you know, because, you know, I have to make it all look good. And I used to put all my empties in her bin. Like, so I was always up. And I'd put them in her bin, and I'd hear this. My accent is from the Midlands in Ireland, and I'd hear all the Cork girls, place in Ireland, and they'd talk like this. They'd be like, all the domestic staff were Cork, and they'd go, "Jesus, girl, did you see Sister Anne's bin? I think she's a bit of an alky." And I'm like, ah. Like, I just thought it was hilarious. Like, I just thought it was hilarious. And I woke up one morning, and I saw in my wardrobe that apparently I had purchased a bright cherry glow-in-the-dark job tracksuit. Like, I'm talking, turn off the light, she'll find me, right? And I'm like, Jesus, like, I must have been drunk when I bought it, but I was, because I don't remember having any recollection of it. And so I had this cherry tracksuit, and then I got my hair shaved. This is like a 3. I've got much more feminine since I've come to the fellowship. And you too, stay sober, regain your femininity. And so this is a thank you. Thank you, everybody. I'm here all week. So I'd have my hair shaved on a number 1. And, like, I'd have this blue tack to stick my hat on, my nurse's hat, because my hair was so short. And I'd have this cherry tracksuit, like, you'd see me coming. And I really thought in my craziness that if I had this cherry tracksuit on and my hair short, because I got frightened that nobody would ever know that I was female. Now, I don't know if you can see where you're sitting, but, like, I have a set of twins under my top, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, I shared that one time in Coveen. I was sharing at a meeting, I was like, I've got a set of twins, blah, blah, blah. And this guy comes up to me afterwards, in his 80s, and gives me a hug, and he goes, "I just came up to say hello to the twins." I was like, oh! And then I grabbed him and was like, "Well, let's say hello to them properly." I thought he was going to have a heart attack on the spot. I was like, "Don't play with me, because I'll bring it on." So, you know, he's like, oh. Anyway, so I thought my tracksuit would hide that, and my hair was short, and, you know, if I walked like this, then nobody would know, because I was drinking in bars with all men, you know. And a lot of stuff happens. I'm a huge blackout drinker. I'm coming out of blackout. I don't know who you are. I don't know where I am. I came out of a blackout one night, and I was in a biker's den in the East End of London. And it was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And you know these, you know these horrible places where there's one light bulb and it's just swinging. There's no lampshade, and there's like all this mess on the wall, and there's all these bikers on. And this one light is swinging. I come out of blackout, I'm disorientated. I don't know where I am. I don't know. And this light was just irritating the hell out. And I kind of make my way out of the door, and there's all these bikes, and there was a plank. That was the step into the house, a plank of wood. That'll tell you how classy it was. And I go down this plank. I don't know, I'm so disorientated. There's a train station here, it's dark, I don't know where I am. And I go back into blackout. And I come back out of blackout, and I'm in the nurse's home again. Don't know how I got there, have no clue what happened. That's how I drink. I'm a huge blackout drinker. And I say, thank God for blackout, frankly. So all this stuff was happening to me, and then I'm trying, people are commenting on my drinking. So I'm going to, for a couple of drinks in the evening. I'm drinking all day, but I go to the bar at night with my tracksuit on me. And I remember I glow in the dark. So, and I go over for evening vespers because I'm serious about becoming a nun. And I'm in the back of the church chapel, and the sisters, the real sisters, are singing Salve Regina. And I'm thinking, oh, these poor girls, you know, they can't hold a note. I'm going to help the sisters out. And so, like, I'm lit up like a Christmas tree in the back of my tracksuit on. And I'm like, Salve Regina, Mater Misericordiae, Vitae Dulcedo, Espes Nostra Salve. And they're like, they're looking back, and I think they're going, damn. Wow, honey, we could do that. Now I know they're looking back going, oh my God, like, what is that? Like, so my delusional little mind, I'm thinking, that's right, I'm helping the sisters out. And then I go back over to the bar. Like, I was just such a joke. I didn't know that. And I had an incident one time where, I thought I saw an advert for Castlemaine Forex and I decided to go to Australia. Just on the fly, as you do. And so I land in Australia. I end up staying with all these nuns. I was telling them I was becoming a nun, and I ended up in all these convents all over Australia. And I paid a fortune to go, I was 20 years of age, and I paid a fortune to go on this glass-bottom boat in the Great Barrier Reef, one of the seven wonders of the world. And I'm on this glass-bottom boat, and there's girls my age, and they're in bikinis. And they're going, let's go snorkeling! And I'm like, look at those silly cows. Look at them. How pathetic are they? Now, the truth was, I was sitting there with long sleeves on me because I've been cutting myself really badly. The truth was, I wouldn't even get in a swimsuit, never mind a bikini, because I was so ashamed of my body. Like, you know when you're 20, you think you're huge, right? So I look back at pictures, and then I was kind of banging. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, damn. Like, well, I won't give that back. You know, but at the time, you're like, oh, I'm so self-conscious. So, like, I couldn't do that, but... So what I started to do is I started to take pictures of the can of Foster's. It's a beautiful can, so don't judge, right? I mean, that blue is really nice. It's a beautiful metallic blue. And the kangaroo is like silver, then with the red stars. I mean, it's like obsession. I can still remember this. And this was over 27 years ago. I still remember that can. And I'm watching. I'm on a glass bottom boat in the Barrier Reef. And I'm taking pictures of how pretty that blue is with the sun hitting the can. I've got a lot of pictures of that can of Foster's. I have not got one picture of the Great Barrier Reef. So, like, obsession, right? Obsession. And nothing wrong with me. And I come back and I have what I have. I have my first moment of clarity when I get back. It was coming up to my 21st birthday. My birthday's in September, and I was coming up to my 21st birthday. Somebody had upset me, and frankly, it's not difficult. Because if you haven't figured out by now, I'm like 0-60 in a heartbeat. I'm like, excuse me, what? If I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. All right, sit down. Like that's how I spoke to people. And people are like, what? Like, I'm 4'11", so people are like, what? I just hit up these bouncers. I'm like, hello, how are you? Yeah, yeah. Like, I just was obnoxious. And people just couldn't believe it, and I was just had a mouth and a half on me, and somebody had upset me, 0-60. I go into my room, I'm drinking a bottle of whiskey, and I'm standing at the window, looking out the window, and I'm playing Patsy Cline, you know, today I sat alone at a window, because I was at a window, I don't want to play house, no, I don't want to play house, like nobody's in there, it's just me, like I have no clue what's going on there. And I continue drinking this bottle of booze, and I go over to the sink, and I suddenly cut myself really badly, and I'm suddenly struck sober. Boom. Like, suddenly struck sober. And I catch eyes with myself, and I think, what am I going to do? I can't live with booze, and I can't live without it. And I picked up the booze and a bottle of whiskey, and I drank for another 3.5 years. And I was 24 and a half when I got sober. And I always count that 6 months, because it was rough, right? So I was like, I was 26 and a half and I got 24 and a half when I got sober, and I drank like that. My drinking just got worse. I got in more and more trouble. I'm cutting myself and I can't stop the bleeding. The doctors get called. I mean, it's crazy. And then I think that I'm gonna become spiritually fit, and I'm drinking to the point now where I can't actually feel my body, and booze has stopped working. Isn't that brutal? You know when you drink a bottle of whiskey and your head is wide awake and your body is drunk. It's like you drink yourself sober somehow, and you can't escape your head anymore. And so, like, I'm totally paralyzed from here down. And you know, people are kind of grateful I had the misfortune of not being able to speak either. And I'm so drunk that I'm in a position where anything can happen. And I'm like, who is this guy? What's going on? Where am I? What's happened? I can't move from the neck down. And my head is wide awake. And oh, my God, I think I'm wetting myself. I can't move. And that's how drinking had ended up for me. Like, I could not escape my head anymore. And I ended up kind of moving to this retreat center in the East, in London, the Ursuline Nuns. And I lived there, and the church was just above me. That chapel in this building was a beautiful, like, 18th century Victorian home. And it was a retreat centre for young people, and I was going to get sober. I knew I had a problem with booze, so I was going to get sober, and I was going to not drink anymore, and I was going to not cut myself anymore, and I was going to get spiritually fit. I thought it was going to be that easy. And I'm there 2 days, and they did this beautiful room for me, and it's really lovely. Like, it's nothing like I've ever had before. It was nice, and everything was new, and it was my first experience of that. I ended up getting so drunk and cutting myself so badly, I smashed up the room. I smashed the lamp, and I put my fist through the wardrobe, through the, I'm good at that, you know, put my fist through the wardrobe, the glass in the wardrobe, and I'm cutting myself. They had to call the doctor out. I mean, I drank like that for 9 more months. That's how it was. Like, that's as good as it got for me. I thought I was gonna be, it was gonna be different. And I was just gonna move, and it was gonna be different. But it brought me with me, and my alcoholism, I thought I had some control, I had no control whatsoever. You know, I'm cycling down to the Chinese. I started to drink this ginseng beer because I think it's healthy for you. And so, you know, I cycle all the way over to this Chinese and I go, can I have some egg fried rice and 12 cans of ginseng beer, please? Just forget about the rice, I just want the beer. And I couldn't understand why that wasn't working. Like, I tried everything, but to stop drinking terrified me. My last drink, I was in a bar and I should have been working, and I didn't. I started drinking at 11 o'clock in the morning, and I drank all the way through. I met two guys in a bar, and they brought me to the British Legion, like an Irish girl in the British Legion. You know, I insulted everybody in there. And I was in that blackout. This guy was trying to take advantage of me, and somebody else stopped. It was very messy. Anyway, I come home. Apparently, because I'm in blackout, I get home late that night, drunk. There's 60 young people that have come to our retreat centre, and they're having a reconciliation service, which in Catholicism is a forgiveness service. And apparently, in blackout, I'd cut myself really badly, and at midnight, I'd gone into the chapel where they all were, and I bled all over the carpet and told Sister Anne what I thought of her in a lot of colourful language. I don't remember any of that. I remember waking up the next morning, and I do a survey of the room. The room is mashed up. Anything that's ever worth anything to me, gifts people buy me, I just smash it all up. I wake up, I look at my arms, they're all ripped up. I go into the bathroom, and I'm bringing up blood. And I'm on my knees bringing up blood, and I'm at the jumping off place again at 24 and a half, and I'm thinking, you might as well just kill yourself, you're such a loser. Booze has stopped working. And to be honest, I was a loser. Like, I'd never had a job where they didn't just take the money out. I'd never paid a bill in my life. I'd never had a relationship. Like, I had some stalking experiences, don't get me wrong. And I insist that we all have a good time because it's my obsession, you know what I'm saying? But I'd never actually had a relationship. And, and I'd never driven a car. Like, anything that was required any kind of sense of maturity, and I knew I was a loser. And I remember so clearly on my knees bringing up blood thinking, you should just kill yourself because you're a loser. And the idea of living without booze devastated me. I mean, I'm a bar drinker. I've been in bars since I was a child. The idea of that, I couldn't even contemplate it. So I made a decision to kill myself that morning. I go upstairs and I'm drinking some hot water, which is what I always drank when I was hungover, this boiling water that used to get down me. And I'm shaking. And the guy who brought the group to the house was... he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was 9 months sober, and he was on fire with the fellowship. And he saw me perform the night previously. And so he basically 12-stepped me, and what have I got to lose, you know what I mean? The only reason I listened to him was because he was Irish. And because everybody I live with was British, and everybody knows that the British are kind of, you know, anal. And... like, you know what I mean, they don't know how to have a good time, not like us Irish, and let their hair down. So I knew they didn't get me. But this guy was Irish, and he 12-stepped me. And four days later, which was the longest I'd ever gone without a drink, because I'm a daily drinker, and it was the longest I'd ever gone, he brought me to my meeting. My first meeting was a Wednesday night, and I was getting ready to have a drink again, and nobody was speaking to me because of the way I've been behaving. And I never knew how to have a civil conversation with anybody. Like, I was very rough. Like, I was raised very rough. Like, I'm a barfly. I've no education. Education was not important in our family. My mother was semi-illiterate. My father was illiterate. My mother was involved in criminal activity. As long as they didn't bring the cops to the door, that was that. She didn't care. So we were really kind of wild and do whatever we wanted. And so I had no, like, I had no social graces whatsoever. Like, I'd slap you down and think it was funny. And you'd be bleeding on the floor, and I'm like, oh, Jez, you're so sensitive, get over yourself. Like, that's how I was, really rough with people, and, you know, making friends everywhere I went. And so I was totally alone, and my family at this stage had stopped speaking to me, and I go to my first meeting, and it's a small, smoky room, right? Like, truly anonymous. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. It was April 1993, which is my sobriety day, and I go in, and I don't even know if I'm the youngest there. I don't care. Like, I just know, I don't know if I'm alcoholic. I just know when I drink, I can't stop drinking, and I'm always thinking about drinking, and I never get anything done, and I never achieve anything, because to have a drink is always a better idea. Even though when I plan not to, that's how it is. And I knew that. And so people were sharing, and I never thought, oh, I'm home, or I've arrived. I was curious. My curiosity was piqued. And Seamus brought me home that night. And there was a woman at that meeting who gave me a big book. And I was super suspicious of women. You know, men are much more friendlier, aren't they? Yeah. And I was super suspicious. Like, so she gave me this big book, and she gave me her number. And I was nervous and suspicious. But I called her the next morning. I woke up that morning, and I was like, oh my God, I haven't had a drink for 5 days. 5 days. This AA business really works. That's how crazy I was. So I started to think about this, and I started to try and stay sober. It was so hard for me. I wanted to drink for about 17 months on a daily basis. I'm not kidding. 17 months on a daily basis, I wanted to drink. I exercised all the time. I walked all the time. I thought, oh, if only I lost weight, then I'd feel better about myself. Like, I prayed to Jesus it was an outside job. Because I felt so messy. I couldn't have a conversation with people. I'd open my mouth and I'd insult people. People upset me constantly. Like, the world would be a great place if none of you were around. Like just, I was irritated constantly. And I was either, in my early sobriety, super, super angry and enraged, or super, super depressed. Like, nothing in between. There was nothing in between. And I started to call this woman, and she wasn't my sponsor or anything like that, because, you know, I'm not a joiner, frankly. And I still think, I go around people's houses and they go, let's play a board game, and I want to stab myself. Like, I'm like, let's not pretend we did. I don't want to. Like, I've learned over the years to go, great, that'd be great. And then I lose the first, oh, damn. And now I can go back and watch the paint dry, because it's much more interesting to me. Like, I'm just not a joiner. Any sport I do is totally on my own. I'm just not interested in playing a board game with you. Please don't ask me. I don't want to. Let's play. No. Like, I still feel like that, you know, 22 plus years sober. I'm like, no. I can do certain things. That's not one of them. You know, so for me, I started to walk everywhere because of this rage I had. And I was intense. Remember that intensity I talked about in my early, when I was, before I drank? That intensity came back, and all the damage I'd done to my booze, in the booze, just kind of made it even more intense. So now, people in the house who weren't in recovery or anything like that, I'd meet them on the stairs, and they'd go, morning, Julie, and they'd go, how are you? And I'd go, oh my God, did I tell you I was abused when I was 5? People are like, and I'm like, you've asked me, and I'm going to keep you hostage until I'm finished talking. I don't care if you're looking around, you're like, Jesus, you know. Like, I was intense. And I was angry all the time. I'd go walking. They used to call me the walker in Britain. I have people I sponsor now who won't walk 5 minutes to a meeting. Or they won't get on a bus. And I'm like, live in California, for Christ's sake. Walk, and I'll meet you there. They're like, oh, what about if someone sees me? Like, what on earth? I don't know what that's all about. Like, I lived in London. London people. The weather's not friendly. So I'd walk to this meeting in my cherry glow-in-the-dark job tracksuit, because all I had no money. I was totally unemployable, so I'd be walking, had no money, It was like a 2.5 hour walk to this meeting on Wednesday night. And it was my first lesson of learning to do something different, because cars would be tooting their horn, you know, and I'd be flipping them off, right? Like, because I'm like, they want a piece of this, you know what I'm saying? And I'd get to the meeting, and people would say to me, these Irish guys would go, Jesus, Julie, I saw you walking. That's a 2.5 hour walk. I saw you walking. And I took the horn to pull over and give you, and if you gave me the bird, and I thought, feck her, let her walk. And I was like, oh my God. Like, it was my first experience. You don't have an ego, people. Like, my first experience of being embarrassed. Because when I was drinking, I'd say something to you and I'd never wait for your response. You'd go to speak and I'd go, shh, don't speak, you'll spoil it. So, you know, I don't want to hear it. Call a friend. I'm not interested. And, you know, I when these guys would say that to me, I was like, oh, like, it's so hard every week when I'd be walking not to just automatically flip people off. It's just my MO. Like, I'll just do whatever I feel like, thanks. But I realised people can see me. We can see you. Oh, so it was my first experience of any kind of discipline. And, I had a hard time reading and writing when I got sober. And so I learned how to read and write again. And a friend of mine showed me how to use a dictionary and a newspaper and showed me how to do my ABCs and all that kind of stuff. And I built that skill up again. And so I was able to read at meetings and that kind of stuff. And the one thing, I never read the big book. I never got a sponsor, none of that business. My whole concept of God left as soon as I got sober, felt totally abandoned. But I'll tell you what happened. When I'd walk to meetings and I'd sit in a meeting for an hour and a half, we wouldn't have a break, not like you lot here. Like, you're all so sensitive, you have a break halfway through, because, you know, who can sit for an hour and a half? Well, in London, they're sitting for an hour and a half. So it's a discipline, right? So you sit for the hour and a half, which I love. I can't stand the break, because I'm just getting settled, and we have a break. Oh, hey, how are you? And the meeting's over by the time I got settled again. You know what I mean? Like, oh. So I love the hour and a half break, where I'm just like a break from everybody. I can sit in meetings, and I just felt better when I went to meetings, and I don't know how that worked. I didn't do any step work. I didn't read the book. I didn't do any. I just felt better. And people were kind to me, and I was not somebody that took that well. I mistook kindness for weakness, and I was very hard on me. And when I'm hard on me, I'm hard on you. Like, your 100% better look like my 100%, and if it doesn't, I'm going to let you know about it. And I'm not going to hide about that. I'm going to be just aggressive with you. I was very rough. And for me, as I started to, my sponsor used to call this a grace period. Like, I had a grace period for about the first 3 years of my recovery, where I went to meetings and I socialized and didn't do anything else. And then I hit this terrible depression. And I started to read the big book, and I was so horrified. You know, in the big book where it talks about half measures availed us nothing. I thought for 3 years that people were reading half measures of ale did nothing. And so I'd share back, oh, Jesus, half a measure of ale never did me any good. And when people were like, what the hell is she? Like, and so, like, when I read that, I was horrified. I was like, you moron. Like, I was mortified. Like, I was getting it wrong for 3 years. And I'll tell you what happened. I didn't have a sponsor, but I was in a relationship that I'm still in 21 years later, and my now spouse is also in the fellowship, and she said something I didn't like, and I kicked the door in her face. It was such rage sober. I kicked the door in her face, and she shot back, it missed her, thank God, and I looked at her, and I was really embarrassed, because I'm a survivor. You throw me in somewhere, and I'll figure out what you want from me. I'll give it to you so you can go away. And I'm good like that, and I'm a good survivor. And I was suddenly embarrassed, because I can talk in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can do this and all that, but what am I doing when no one's watching? Well, what am I doing when no one's watching? And my sponsor always talks about this, like, character is built in the dark. Character is built in the dark, and I didn't understand that. And I'll tell you what really helped me with that, the Just For Today card. Just for today, I'll do something for somebody and not get found out. I still implement that in my life today. It really helps me. Just for today, I'm going to do something for some, like, I'll wash the cabinets at work when nobody's there, or I'll rinse out the mugs and put them back, or I'll just do something when no one's around, and it just builds up my own sense of integrity. And it's been super helpful for me. And so I got a sponsor because I was embarrassed. I started to cry and kind of slid down the wall and realized here I am professing to care about somebody and love somebody, and yet I don't like what they say, and this is how I'm going to treat them. And boom, this rage, you know, would come up in me. And so my grace period was well and truly over. I had to get a sponsor. And I got a sponsor who was an older woman, old Irish woman, who frightened me because she was kind. And I don't do kind. And every time I see her, she'd hug me. And I'm like, oh my God, she's touching me. Like, you know, like she'd go, hello, Julie, love, how are you? Oh, and I want to be cool. So I want to go, oh yeah, I'm great, thanks. And inside, I'm like, Jesus, can you get away from her? You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, it's creeped out. And I was sitting at a meeting. I remember it so clearly on a Sunday afternoon. And I thought, you should ask Anne to sponsor you. Oh my God, I don't know. She frightens me. Well, perhaps you need to be frightened a little bit. Perhaps it would be good for you to learn how to be kind. Like, people would call our house and they'd ask for my wife and not me. And I'd be like, hey, I'm so glad you called. And they'd be like, is Hilda there? Nobody wants to talk to me because I'm such a bitch. So, like, I was like, oh. So I started to kind of ask Anne to sponsor me. She was my first experience of the book, of the big book, and kind of gone through the steps. And I started to go back to school. I learned how to read and write, and I decided I wanted to get some education. And it's funny how that happens, right? Like, I was not driven at all, had no discipline, did whatever I felt like, showed up whenever I wanted. And I've now got 4 degrees. I've got a bachelor's, I've got 2 masters, and I got a doctorate last year. And so it's like, who knew? Like, who knew? I didn't know I was that motivated. I didn't know I could do that. And I only learned that by doing a class at a time, a course at a time. And because of the way I conduct myself, people liked me. And so they would offer me opportunities to stay on and do different things. And it was, you know, like, so, you know, it was, and I'm the first person in my family to get any education. And it was a big deal for me. And I worked and studied. And you know, for me, I got the sponsor. She brought me through the steps. And it was so hard for me to do step 4, you know, because I was like, you know, in the big book it talks about, are we the pursued or the pursuer? And I always thought I was the pursued, that everybody was doing to me. In other words, I was the victim, and I was only defending myself. And I couldn't see my part in it at all. And when I started to look at the fourth column, I realized that I wasn't a great daughter. And I realized that, you know, I was so indifferent to people. Like, I didn't really have a genuine feeling about anybody. I didn't know that. And my first step 4, there was 10 people on my list. And I told you how many siblings I have. There was 10 people on my first step 4 because I was so indifferent to people. And the book talks, I think the 12 and 12 talks about, you know, we love a few, we hate the rest, and we're indifferent to many, or the other way around. And I was totally indifferent. Like, I pretend we were friends, and you'd give me your number. Yeah. As soon as I'm out the door, that goes straight in the trash can. Like, I'm indifferent to people. And I didn't know that about myself. 10 people on my first step 10, and that was seriously all I could think about. And you know, I knew the steps were working when I graduated with my bachelor's degree. I was graduating in Canterbury Cathedral, right, in London. And my mother was in Ireland, and she flew from Ireland to see me graduate. And I knew I was getting better because as I walked, I didn't see her, she came from Ireland and went straight to the cathedral. And as I was walking down, my hat and gown and the trumpets blowing, and I'm delighted with myself, I'm walking down, I'm 5 years sober, I catch eyes with my mother, and she's really tore back. She's hungover, which she was every morning of my life, and she's kind of felt awkward in herself and she was uncomfortable. And I knew the steps were working because I was absolutely delighted she made it. She came all the way from Ireland that morning. And she was hungover and tore back and all that, but I didn't care. I was so delighted she'd made the effort. And I knew that she was tore back because she was celebrating me all night and telling everybody that she was coming to England to see her daughter graduate and da 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 da. And I was so moved by that because I resented her and I hated her when I got sober. And there was a lot. I mean, she was an alcoholic mother, so, you know, we know how that is. Nobody's paying any attention to anything. And she was easy to blame. There was a lot of fodder for me to be a victim. And it was a beautiful experience. And I brought my mum to the airport and I told her that I loved her. And we don't do that in our house. And I hugged her. And I was laughing about this with Lee earlier, that in my house, if anybody comes towards you, you duck real quick. I mean, that's how it is. Like, we don't touch each other. We're like, oh, sorry about that. Sorry, you want to kill yourself. See you tomorrow. You know, like, we're like, oh, awkward, you know what I mean? So I give my mum a hug and she just looks at me and she's like, I'm so proud of you. And it was such, I was so moved. And she left and she's awkward, you know, so she leaves and she gets on a plane. And my dad was a whole different thing. Like, this isn't a common experience to have in the fellowship, but it's my experience nonetheless. And I was going to say, I don't care, I'll never see you people again, but I come up here quite regularly now, so I probably will. But my experience with my father is that there's a lot of damage done. And I kept going into that relationship and into that relationship and into that relationship. And just sometimes people are just not able to meet you in any way, shape or form. And he was really too mentally unwell. And I just kept getting hurt and I kept getting hurt and I kept getting hurt. And between outside help and sponsorship, I decided to sever that relationship. And I did sever that relationship. And my father had a brain hemorrhage. I didn't have any. It's funny, I hated my father. And then when I did step five, I became kind of numb to him. And then about 9 years so, we had a brain aneurysm. And I went home to Ireland eventually to see him. And he was blind in one eye and he was in a state. I wanted to drink on the plane and I wanted to drink when I got into the town. But I know better than that. And I asked somebody who owns a grocery store in my hometown in Ireland, small little town. And I asked if he would bring me to a meeting that night and he said he would. So I had that set up and then I went to see my father. And he was in bed and he looked terrible. I hadn't seen him for about 4 years. And he was asleep. And the nurse says to me, do you want me to wake him? And I just started to cry and the hatred came up in me. And it caught me off guard. Because, you know, I thought, oh, like, it's great not to have any of that stuff when you don't see anybody. And then you see them, you, like, find out where you're at, really. And so the hatred came up in me and I go, no. And I left, he never knew I was there. And I went to a meeting that night and I shared about it and somebody said to me, why don't you read page 552 in the big book, I think it's 552, where you talk about praying for somebody and, you know, for 2 weeks. And I did. I was like reading the big book and I go the next day and I see my father, he's awake. And I wipe his mouth and I let him touch me and I bring him to the garden and we've got nothing to say. And I go back to a meeting that night and I share about it and then I go back the next day and I tell him, I'm leaving. I was coming to California to live and I go, I'm leaving now, Daddy, and you won't see me again. And he started to cry. And he knew in that moment, he kind of felt like there was such a relief. Like he looked at me and he goes, I'm going to miss you now. And I said, yeah. And I left and hadn't seen my father since. And I left that place and I went into the chapel there and I just cried and cried. It was such a relief moved off of me. Like it was so hard to face him and it took me 9 years to get there. So sometimes we want to rush all this stuff, and it's not my time, it's God's time. And that's hard when you want to get these things done, but I just kept making a mess of the thing. And so I go into the chapel, and I cry and cry about the whole thing. And, you know, 4 years ago I got a call, my father was dying, and I went home to Ireland, and I got trapped at the airport at LAX, and the flight got cancelled. And I was in line with 400 other people for about 2 hours, and I get a call from my sister, Daddy just died. And it caught me again off guard. I started to cry and I was off, I you know. And so they put me on a plane. Oh my God, I went to a plane. I went to like New York and that was Friday. I didn't get home to Ireland until Sunday. So I traveled New York and I don't know where I was, but I traveled and I cried the whole time. And it was funny, I always think about that airplane movie, kind of dark humor where, I don't know if you guys are old enough or watch this kind of business stuff up in this lovely little place, but airplane movie where the guy gets on and he starts telling this old lady about his life, she ends up hanging herself and he keeps talking. It's like I had that kind of experience at the airport. I was, after being up for 48 hours, I was crying the whole time, and I'm sitting down and I go, she goes to me, hey, how are you, this girl, before we got on the plane, and I go, oh my God, you never guess what's happened to me, and I just tell her me. And after I finished, she just looked at me, she goes, oh my God, this is the worst story I've ever heard. And she got up and left. And I burst out laughing because I suddenly thought about the airplane movie. When I got on the plane, she was a seat next to her. She's like, oh. No. She was looking for the rope. Like, no. That's so funny. And but I call my sponsor and I'm like, why would God do this? Blah, blah, blah. Why am I trapped here? And she says to me, did you ever think, Julie, it was God's way of helping you grieve, how you needed to grieve before you had to go home and face your family? Well, no, I didn't. No, I don't think that. But it made perfect sense to me, and it was a very comfort to me. And I was able to go to the funeral, and I was able to act appropriately and have some integrity and be a decent member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I had some comment, oh, we didn't think you were coming and all that. And I'm like, well, why wouldn't I? Like, I'm not explaining myself to you. I know what I'm at. I don't need your approval for it either. So I was like, no, well, why wouldn't I? And Irishmen are kind of like, oh, okay. You know, there's no confrontation going on. So I go to the funeral, and then on the Friday before I leave, I bring my dad these biscuits that he loved to the cemetery. And he was always so tight, he'd never buy them for himself, and he was diabetic, so he should never been eating them. And I bought this whole thing of biscuits, and as I'm walking to the cemetery, I hear my father in my head saying, Jesus, you brought me my favourite. And so I sit down by the cemetery, by his grave, and I put the biscuits there. And I feel like I had just had a great conversation with my father, and I cried out how long I was there. And I felt totally at peace about that whole thing. Totally at peace. And there's nothing I would change about that whole thing. I have no regrets. And other people in my family don't necessarily understand that. I don't really care. It's not my concern. I know what I'm at. And I'm good with that. And so it was a lovely experience. And, you know, for me, I've had a really hard 6 months. You know, my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and it's been so hard. I was home three times last year. And I went home in July, and she was in such a state that it just devastated me. And I was devastated by the whole thing. And so hard when you've had a woman who's been hard and aggressive, and then she's like a little person. When I put her to bed at night, Julie, what about a hug? Is that a noise outside? I mean, it was rough. It really knocked the stuffing out of me. And then we had to find a nursing home because she was getting into a lot of trouble. And I went home in, I think, November with my sisters. And my sister found her nursing home, put her in there. And we had to dismantle her 40, 50 years of stuff. We dismantled the whole thing, and it was so hard. You know that cabinet I talked about with the magnets? I saw that getting carried out the door, and I broke down. And it was really a hard experience, you know. For me, it's been really hard. But I call my mother, and I try and call her every couple of days, and I tell her I love her, and it's just been difficult. And so I kind of feel like I've been in this huge grief period over the last 6 months. And I'm starting to feel a little bit stronger in myself. It's still hard to call her. It's hard to call her, but it's kind of cool. When I was a kid, the one fond memory I have of my mother is that every year she'd grow this flower. It was a hyacinth, right? And she'd grow this flower for me every year, and it smelled so good in that. So she'd put tea leaves on it, and she'd give it 7-Up and lemonade, and I'd win first prize every year, and it was like a memory of her. And when I was going through this, I was walking through the corridor at work, and I could smell this flower. And it was, you know, like, smell is like our strongest sense of memory out of all our senses. And so I was like, I know that because I've been to school now. And and so I'm wandering along, and I smell this, and I go, oh. And so I asked my boss. She goes, you can take it home. Now, I have not got green fingers, all right? Like, no. Everything I talk to dies, plant-wise. And so I bring this plant home, and I thought it was dead as a doornail on the patio, and I'm talking to it, I'm trying to water it, nothing's going on. And a couple of weeks ago, after all the heavy rains, I was away in Oklahoma speaking, and I came back, and there's these little shoots that came up, and I started to cry. I was so moved, and I knew it was nothing to do with me. But now I've been taking pictures of it. Now it's purple, and it smells so good. And it just makes me, and I call my mum, I talk to her about it. I go, you remember that plant? What do you think I should do with it? Think I should put some tea leaves on it? Yeah, tea leaves are great. Like, you know, I was totally leaving the conversation. But it was lovely. It's lovely to have something like that and to have a fond memory, to be able to nurture that and breathe life into it, and for us to be able to have that together is lovely for me. And here it is, you know, for me, I wake up anxious. I've always woken up anxious. I'm always on like a level 5 anxiety, right? Like, that's just my base. Other people, like my wife wakes up, like I wake up going, oh my God, what day is it? And who wants something from me? Now, she's also alcoholic, but she wakes up singing, which I think is creepy, but whatever. I'm like, oh, like, I wonder how that happened. I don't know how that works, because I'm like, oh my God. That's how I wake up, like, alcoholism is on me when I wake up, right? We have a daily reprieve. When I wake up, it's like, hello. So it's like, so I get up, I make a serious cup of tea. Not this Lipton business, you lot tried to push his tea. I don't know what's going on, but it's criminal, just saying. So I get this tea from Ireland and I make a strong cup of tea. I open my big book, page 86 to 88. I read that and it gets me centered. And then I read page 130. You know, we've come to believe in a power greater than ourselves who'd like to keep our head in the clouds with him, but our feet ought to be firmly planted on earth. Because that is where our fellow travellers are, and that is where our work must be done. Like, it reminds me, it's no good if I'm levitating. Do you ever levitate, and then you leave the house, and you hear someone screaming and realise it's you? You know, do you ever have that experience? I've had that experience. And I'm like, oh my God, like, we've just been levitating for the last 10 minutes, and now I want to kill this guy in front of me because it's not going fast enough. So it's like, oh my God, Jesus, you know. So I've really tried to think about spirituality as practical application. How I conduct myself, try to be present to each person I talk to, and try to just kind of slow my roll when I'm driving. To me, they're practical applications. Bill Wilson talked about that. At this stage of the game, I could kind of, you know, I call my sponsor daily. I go through step work. I have sponsors who call me. I have regular meetings that I'm disciplined enough to show up to. I have a career, and I dedicate an appropriate time to that. So, you know, life is in session for me. And, you know, I really, just recently I've been praying, doing step page 25, about this idea of, you know, we've come to believe that the Creator's kind of entered our hearts. And it's really been lovely for me. It's helped me get through a lot of fear. And I've been able to kind of get focused again after the whole experience with my mom. And life is in session for me. It's in session. It's pretty good, but I can get in my own way, and I can get into trouble, and I can manufacture problems and manufacture misery. And so I try to keep those disciplines going every day, keep my feet on the floor and breathe. And it's been really nice because all areas of my life are in pretty decent shape. And that doesn't happen by accident. It happens by me applying myself and being awake. Like, I'm awake, and so I don't allow myself to get away with very much. And after this, so I will go gambling and smoke a cigar and blow off a little steam, because, you know, I want to keep it real up in here. I'm sober, I'm not dead, so that's good to know, right? So, you know, life is pretty good, and I'm just putting one foot in the front of the other, and I'm just grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous, really, for the life that I have that I've been able to build here. Thanks, guys.